Now we're going to do a little miscellaneous lesson today. You know, last week we talked about the judgments of the tribulation, and I didn't finish my lesson. You know, I mean, I finished what I had prepared, but there's one more lesson I got to do on that out of the Old Testament. So I'll do that probably later. So Thanksgiving lesson in a sense, but in a way it is. And we'll start with the Puritans. You know who the Puritans were. Pilgrims were separatists, not Puritans, although the separatists came out of the Puritans. The Puritans, and we're gonna, in America, we're going to start 1630. Puritans made a big mistake when they adopted historic theology rather than biblical theology. They went to their history lessons and learned from their history rather than go to the Bible to learn from the Bible. So they made a mistake when they adopted historic theology's view of the church. They took on the centuries-old idea that Israel had failed, and they would say understandably, and God had turned to his new people, which we know is the church, according to them. It only took a sleight of hand for the Gentiles to become the new Israel. After all, they had crossed the raging waters, as they did in the Middle East, to inhabit the promised land of America. So they're the new Israel. America is the promised land. The parallels are indisputable, according to them. At this point, it would be interesting to review the tradition of Thanksgiving Day with the pilgrims, as connected with them. But what the Puritans and the pilgrims both had in common was they saw themselves as the new Israel coming to the new land of promise. It's not like an echo. It's okay to repeat myself. Now, this assumption led them to grave, horrible theological mistakes. I can't overstate that. Okay, since they, the Puritans, were the de facto Israelites, then they were obligated to act like them and assume the prerogatives of the chosen people who form a chosen nation in the land of promise. Are you with me? All right. Seems like it's pretty much like this all the way through. So now we're new Israel in the land of promise. And they spoke that way. I'm not making this up. That's how they spoke. The most consequential of their assumption was that they were obligated to keep the Mosaic law, ergo, however it functioned in the old Israel, it was to function in the new Israel. You're going to make this parallel, you got to carry it on. Old Israel's under the law, new Israel's under the law. They lived that way, taught it that way. This false identification led many missteps in how Puritans functioned. They saw themselves under the law. One was the inability to produce a church of believers. We sometimes want to call that a pure church. Maybe that's too offensive for you. What we mean by that, it's a believer's church. They could not produce a believer's church, although they tried and they tried and they tried. Never quite achieved it. Because of their infant baptism practices, everybody was included as part of the covenant, a made-up term. A covenant in the church, that's a made-up term for them. But when the babies grew up to be unconverted adults, the church was populated with unbelievers. Duh. Well, we can leave the unconverted in the church for now because we don't want to talk about that. But can you see the problem they already have? But we do want to focus on the law-keeping as it was assumed obligatory to their New Testament Israel identification. So they were under the law. They said, without the law, how would they know how to order their life? An argument that you still hear. But the assumption of the law put the Puritans in an impossible situation. The assumption taken into the law. They knew that they could not keep the law. They knew that they lived in all kinds of guilt because they couldn't and didn't. Yet their obedience was the primary indicator of owning righteousness. So if they were going to claim to be righteous, they'd have to be keeping the law. They knew they weren't keeping the law. The answer then was that they weren't righteous. They weren't saved. so unreliable or impossible was this 100% obedient requirement, it put the Puritans into a state of emotional uncertainty. We call that depression. They were in a perpetual review of their performance. They were never able to ascertain whether they had come to salvation or not. This uncertainty leads to living under a heavy burden without the peace and joy that they knew they should have, but never could acquire it. Therefore, Jonathan Edwards, we call him the last Puritan, suffered under depression much of his life, a great man, a great theologian that he was, never quite sure of his eternal state. And I'm not going to do this for you, but in my class, and I'm going to get into John Wesley and those guys and how they even thought they weren't even believers anymore at the end of their life. And it all is traceable back to this idea that they can't keep the law and the law condemns them. They understand that. They consider themselves unrighteous. Antinomian, Gil's talked about this not too much, too long. I mean, he's talked about it quite a bit. It's not Wednesday night on Galatians. It's against law. So if you're antinomian, you mean you live without the law. So this line of thinking, as we would be called antinomian, this line of thinking continues in our day in covenantalism. They still think they are the new Israel. They still think that we or they or everybody is under the law. That hasn't changed. After all these years of trial and error and missteps and failure, they still think it's possible. Well, those of us who agree with this assessment are called antinomian, that is, without the law. And that is used of us. I mean, today, 2017. It is hard to understand that those who highly regard the New Testament ignore the basic message of Galatians when it says, you are not under law. Well, when I was teaching this on Wednesday night about the Puritans and their view of the law, Gil was going through Galatians Gil's going through it on Sunday night. And it's very, very helpful to really put those in contrast. Now, of course, they, the covenant people, have a well-honed argument that conveniently removes the impossible part of that they cannot keep. So they sort of like surgically remove parts of the law they can't keep. I saw foul ball. They can't keep the law. Well, for some reason or other, they can't do the civil. I mean, you'd have to run the government. And they can't keep the ceremonial because the ceremonial was traceable back to the temple service. We can't do that anymore, but we do have altars in our church. So they try a little bit to affect what looked like would be law-keeping. So they insist that only the moral aspects of the law are obligatory. I'm not always sure where the line is between moral and what. Is the Sabbath-keeping a moral law, or is it not part of the law? Now, while Galatians reminds the reader that the law cannot be broken into parts, it's what it says. By the way, I'm sticking all with just with Galatians. Scholars teaching, and I'm going to say the gullible, you've got to be gullible to believe this stuff. Scholars teaching the gullible can make their case compelling. In fact, these are the intelligentsia of their land these days. These are the smart people. Oh, by the way, law-keeping is really not law-keeping. Law-keeping demands 100% obedience. No one, not even the Jews, could ever make that standard. So what do those who promote law-keeping mean by keeping the law, since they know 100% is impossible? So they are happy just to reduce the crimes. Even if you cannot eliminate bank robbing, you can at least reduce the number of them. So that's law-keeping, is it? No. You had to eliminate all bank robbery. But in their thinking, if we just reduce the amount. So law-keeping really, in their mind, has to be a romantic idea that's not connected to reality and having the actual reality. Okay, said that. Well, the argument goes that they think that if there is no law, then people will be the worst kind of folks. For even antinomian, for them, antinomian is the same as anarchy. And we know what happened in Genesis. Everyone will do what's right in their own eyes. And certainly Christians cannot be trusted to do the right thing. They need a law for sanctification. That's the case. Now I say there ought to be an answer from us, an answer that ought to be clearly understood. I would be wondering, I'm not going to do this to you, I just wondered how you would answer this question. And how, if you can answer this question, see, match it with what I'm going to do for you and see if that was the same, the way you would do it. I don't know what I mean by that, except that there is an answer to this question. And we need to have it at the top of our head or at the end of our fingertips. The answer is this. Simply, the New Testament believer does not depend on law for sanctification. Understand sanctification? That means become holy. To become holy. Quit sinning. That's it. Don't sin. Don't ever sin again, you'll be sanctified. Got it? That's the issue of sin. The New Testament believer does not depend on the law for maturity, sanctification, growth. It depends on the life of Christ. That life of Christ has been infused in the heart of the believer. Everyone, brand new believer, old time believer, the life of Christ is infused in the heart of the believer. And I say this is the basic of basic theology. If you don't understand that when you come to Christ, believe in him for your salvation, and you do not understand he takes up residence in your life, you haven't got to the ABCs. You haven't got to the A of the A, B, and Cs. So this is the basic of basic theology. I don't want to say this is some lofty, you know, after you've been a Christian for 10 years, now you kind of figure this out. No, this is something that a new believer that you've just led to the Lord, you can sit down and say, you know, now that you have trusted Christ, I'm going to trust that you have. And if you really have trusted Christ, the life of Christ has now come to live in your life. Would you not tell a new believer that right away? Because that becomes his basic foundational building block. It says, I have been crucified with Christ, and it is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. In a life which I now live in the flesh, thank you, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself up for me. Now, one question. Who died? First sentence says, I. You know what is the King James word used here? What is the King James word used? It starts with M. Mortify. Mortify. You kill the flesh. It says, I have been crucified with Christ. You know, Christ was crucified, yeah. But when it talks about the living the new life, you have to start out by understanding that I have been crucified. I don't want to die. That's true. I don't want to die. All right, I've been crucified with Christ. Who died? You died. In Christ, you died. It goes on to say the rest of it, all right? So back up a little bit. Before this happens, it is the nature of our birth. It is corrupt, hopelessly enslaved to obey the lust of the flesh. That's, you know, put in a vice and you can't get out of it. It obeys the voice of the demonic, is on the road to destruction and hellfire. That's the old sin nature. And the King James here uses the old, the King James people, old man, the old man. So, who died, I guess, again, in reference to your former manner of life, now in a very mild way of expressing, he says, lay aside the old self. What's another word for lay aside your old self? That's right. It's like putting the body into a coffin, and on the top of the coffin, if you're a Christian, you know, you put a cross on it. You look down there, you see a cross on the body. Okay. So you lay aside the old self, which is being corrupted, by the way. It's getting worse, which is in accordance with the lust of deceit. So the sin nature doesn't ever get better. It gets worse, it says. So who died? So we have that verse again. I have been crucified with Christ. No longer I who live, but I'm alive. But not the I that died. The I that died, but Christ lives in me. And now, after this is over, the life which I now live in the flesh, my suit, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself up for me. So that little box, this little box, is the coffin. And you're looking down on the hole, there's an X on it and a cross on it, on which you died. Not Christ, on which you died. He died for you too, but in a different way. So now we have a new nature that has come alongside the old nature. Because it says, because Christ lives in me, the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God. Notice down here, I say this is one person. They're not two persons. There are two natures. One person, two natures. Don't get that mixed up. You've got to have one person. Okay, with the new nature added, We have the capacity that was not present before. Do I have to go back and show you? Didn't have that? Before you had no choice which master to obey. Now the choice is yours which to obey. The choice is yours. Now, in reference to the former manner of life, lay aside the old self. There, I did that for you. There's the coffee. Looking down, see the cross on the lid. Now, what would happen to your life if sin nature were removed or killed or rendered inoperative, however you want to call it? Which nature would be in control? And we all can say the new nature, right? Now, there's an if in there. I realize that. If the sin nature were removed, but we're supposed to do that, it says. So if the old sin nature was removed, what do I look like now? So what would happen? Same question. If the sin nature were removed or is killed, rendered inoperative, which nature would control? And you said it, the new nature. There's nothing left except the coffin in the box in the grave buried, rendered inoperative. Well, my question now is, would this life ever sin? That's not a trick question. Look at my picture. What is it to say there? There's a new nature. It's in charge. Would this life ever sin? Would this life, that one, ever sin? Would it ever desire an improper thing? Would it always do the right thing? Would it desire a wrong outcome? Would it be guilt-ridden? All right, see, now we got it. Now we should take and go through all of 1 John. Because this is the assumption 1 John makes. He says, Christians, do not sin. Well, that can't be true. I'm a Christian. I've sinned a lot of times. But when you look at it this way, this person in control by the new nature does not, cannot sin. With this pressure on us, is Psalm 37:4, which I quote for you here, really possible? Which is where I started with my lesson. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Under this paradigm, this model, will this work? Absolutely. Absolutely. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desire of your heart, if the new nature is in charge. The new nature is not controlled by the law, is it? See, here's where we depart with our covenant people. Because new nature cannot be doesn't need to be controlled. It just is what it is. I would say it's perfect. It is. When Christ gave me his life, it was a perfected life. And that life lived out is a perfected life. The new nature is not controlled by the law, but the principles of faith and love. Also out of Galatians. How does this work? Well, it's faith in God's provision. This is possible. Go back to my statement over here. Delight yourself in the Lord. He desire, and he will give you the desire of your heart. How can that be? God promises it. Aha, faith in God's provision. And there's one other little thing that you got to be remembering here is that your love toward your brother. You don't do things against your brother that would hurt him or his. That's in Galatians, which I'll quote in a minute here. So faith in God's provision and love towards my brother, operating under the power of the new nature, is all I need. In fact, they both come out of the new nature, frankly. Because Galatians 5:6 says, for in Christ Jesus, neither circumcision or uncircumcision, in other words, the law, for neither the law nor the unlaw means anything. It is nothing. What is important is that faith working through love is everything. So the faith is in what I just said, faith in God's provision and love towards my brother. I mean, I could just sum it up in two words, faith and love. Faith towards God, love towards others. And that's expressed in the new nature without any challenge. So we have the rest of verse 37, chapter 37, it's set up for something. I'd like to read the verses around it that I just read to you in verse 4. Do not fret because of evildoers. Do not be envious towards your wrongdoers. You know, we sometimes are this way. For they will wither quickly like the grass and fade like the green herb. Trust in the Lord and do good. There it is. Same thing. Trust in the Lord, believe, and do good towards your brother. And then for the Israel, dwell in the land. Cultivate faithfulness. And then it says, delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Well, we're not off the hook quite yet. As we think about delighting ourselves in the Lord, there's an easy test to see how we are doing in this quest of being responsive to the Lord. And momentarily, it means all the time killing our old nature. Momentarily means not once in a while. It's just all the time, continually putting to death the flesh, because it continually comes back to life when we say it should. By the way, it comes back to life by our will. It comes back from the dead by our will. Just obey it. It's alive again. But it says to mortify the flesh. Kill it. No. I do the wrong thing. I've resurrected again. Then I got to deal with two natures. Kill the flesh. Okay. In keeping with our recent observation of the day of Thanksgiving, we are reminded that Thanksgiving is a way of life for the believer. And I think we all understand that. We sort of revolt a little bit at the Thanksgiving day, like as if we don't express Thanksgiving the rest of our year. But we understand the appreciation, the observation. So this is a biblical principle, in fact, is a first step towards destruction if we fail this step. We go to Romans 1, familiar passage, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness. Boy, is that going on today. Pushing it down. I don't know if it's ever been worse. Everybody says it's never been worse like it is today. You know, it's hyperbole, probably. But it is bad today. I mean, there is places where you could used to say the truth and would be accepted. But today, you can't even hardly say the truth in schools. You can't say the truth in some churches. And you certainly can't say the truth in the public square. Well, this wrath of God is revealed against men who suppress the truth, because that which is known about God is evident within them. They all have a conscience all accusing them, for God made it evident to them. Don't have to take smarts here. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power, divine nature, his power and his being are clearly seen. Clearly seen. We all said, look at the clouds, look at the tree, look at a baby born. Whatever it is God's eternal power being demonstrated in what you can see. And it says, clearly seen. It doesn't say, well, if you look at the right time, the right place, you might get a glimpse. You just go outside and see anything. Sit here, anything, everything we see is made by God. And so they are without excuse. So we sit here kind of smug, huh? Survive the test. We did that all right. Of these verses, we may want to put these verses to work on our atheistic friends, you know, paste it on their backs. But notice how they got to their present state of denying their own creator. For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God. And what did they fail to do? They did not give thanks. But it became futile in their speculation, which is a step way down, and their foolish heart was darkened, and professing wise, they became fools. Now, this giving thanks is a small issue, very small issue, but it is an issue that starts you down the road to the destruction. So it says that even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations. So failure to give thanks, fail to give credit to God is an easy misstep for believers, because he can easily navigate, as an atheist does, to the ungrateful heart. Obviously, he's working in the power of the flesh now, by the way. He has resurrected the old man. But this first step away from obedience is a lack of appreciation for what God has done. Now, here's where I wanted to start my lesson, but I'm going to let you fill in for you, because it is amazing how much we allow grumbling in our lives and do not understand that when we grumble, we're not thankful. You cannot grumble and be thankful at the same time. And I say, wow, that's a high standard. But you grumble at this, you grumble at that. Well, this is not the, and just go down, and pretty soon you're justifying your grumbling, and you forgot what God has done because you're a bit too busy grumbling. And to me, that's a step downward. And it's something you don't want to do. Now, I know we grumble at little things like, you know, it's raining today, I want to go on a picnic. Careful. But we got to be, got to stop the grumbling. And the grumbling, oh, they're justified, though. I mean, you really understand, this is really bad. If you only knew that grumbling, grumbling, grumbling. So my lesson this morning is, when you find yourself grumbling, you know for sure, without doubt, that you are not thankful. And if you are not thankful, you have taken the first step down the road, and there's nothing to stop you from going all the way down. And like Gilroy says, you never know where sin will take you. You don't know where this is going to go. Now, I said, well, I can't think of anything to be thankful for. Well, then I got trouble. I mean, you got trouble. You know, back in the days of Puritans, go back to the Puritans again. They had a very, very difficult time keeping or establishing a pure church. It was fast after one of the Great Awakening events in 1739 that there was so many people had come to the Lord. They were in the church, by the way. That for some, it almost looked like the ideal of the Puritans was going to be realized because the people in the church were also believers. And then what happens? And this is, I don't know, can you be thankful and be angry at the same time? I mean, that was a good test for me. I became angry with the church, particularly, that Jonathan Edwards was pastoring, of how they treated him. Now, they had their reasons. And I said, Jonathan Edwards was no perfect person. But then they said, well, the reason they treated him that way, which is probably true, because this is after the Great Awakening of the 20 years, but that time we got a new generation growing up, looked at the church that Jonathan Edwards pastored and said, well, the reason they threw him out was because they were a bunch of unbelievers. But you can't tell an unbeliever from a believer when they start doing things that are improper. They look alike. So anyway, I just burned my heart this week when I read Jonathan Edwards, how they treated that man. I mean, he still goes, I'm not agreeing with his theology in terms of his law-keeping or his New Israel idea or his post-millennialism. All that is wrong. But the basic issue of the heart, he was dead right on. He was right dead on about the depravity of the heart and the necessity of God's intervention for anybody to be saved. Right dead on. And he said that people that come to the communion table should be at least believers. And the people said, why? And he got thrown out for it. I said, you know, the guy was not perfect. There were things he did that were probably we'd kind of laugh at today. But for those people, it was everything. And they threw him out for that. They threw out the baby with the bathwater. I said, all they would have had to do is go back, take a step back, be thankful for what God has done in this place, in your heart, in the lives of its people, appreciate that, and stop the grumbling. And everybody's happy. Well, but this happened. Well, but this. But he did this. You know, I had this all in Jonathan Edwards' story. I'll tell you what it was with Jonathan Edwards that got it going, partly. Now, I think that there's an excuse for it. Now, this is so strange for us because the young people, he always picked on the young people. The young people had come up on a medical book, medical anatomy book. And these are boys. And they were looking at the pictures. And they were kind of discovering the other sex in their late teenage, early 20s. Now, they didn't just learn something. They now started making fun of the girls and about their menstrual cycles and all these kind of things, you know. And that's, I mean, it seems like, whoa. Well, Jonathan Edwards said, no, you can't do that. So from here on, it falls apart. What are you going to do now? You've got a church of unbelievers and everybody's protecting their own kids. So it fell apart. And eventually it came to the issue of the believers taking communion. But it started with this thing they called the Bible, the Young People's Bible, which was their, I don't know if there's anything comparable to that in our day and age or not. Everything's so open and wow. But that's what started. It's really a silly thing. And my author says he probably didn't handle it very good. I said, I don't know how you'd handle it. You got people together and talked to them, got the parents together, talked to them about this, they should stop this. And for this, he got criticized. I'm not sure how he'd done it differently. All I'm saying is it was a little small thing. And that thing, in some people's mind, wasn't a little small thing, but it was a little small thing. And these people lost their sense of thanksgiving and the gratitude they had for having a pastor that had taught them faithfully from the word for some 20 years, and they threw them out. And that made me mad. It did. I just like, ugh. It made me almost angry at the church because I said, well, how is it that these churches, their bodies of believers, deal with their pastors this way? Where do they get the right to do that? Have I said enough? I don't want to go on. Anyway, any more comments about our little model here about mortifying the flesh. Remember, you still are one person, and all you got to do is, some Indian guy said one time, all I got to do is tell the right dog, Sekhem, and you know, he's the one that prevails. So you keep your flesh dead, you won't sin the rest of the day. You know that? Yes, I know it won't be easy, but that's the recipe, David. Yeah, that's right. It is so simple, but you know what we do? It's an exception. This is an exception. Nothing has been this bad. We can't accept this. But there's a distinction in the Old Testament that the New Testament supersedes the Old. It's the same trick that the Muslims do. They're the last kid on the block, therefore he has the most authority. So, but that's not true. I mean, the New Testament has no more authority than the Old, we say. In fact, we say the Old Testament is the foundation on which the New Testament is built on. The New Testament changes nothing in the Old Testament.
So they tried to follow the law, but yet they brought in the gospel.
Right. So that's what makes it confusing. If they'd rejected everything, it would have been easier because they say, well, they're all apostates. But they kept the gospel, mostly. But then, see, if you go back to the Puritans, the real problem, they had the infant baptism. Once you baptize an infant, he's in the church. He's part of the covenant. Now you can't get rid of him later on when he's going to vote. And when he can vote, I'm simplifying, when he can vote the good guy out of office, the pastor. So you have a mixed church. And they understood that. They understood that. But they were also of the they were also convinced that you couldn't tell the believer from the unbeliever. Because they're all living together. They acted the same. They treated them the same. But like Jonathan Edwards would know, I know that these people come to my communion table are not saved. He would know that, but he didn't have the authority to pull them out and say, you aren't. And when he tried to draw a line by policy, they threw him out. And he went and ministered to the Indians.